I'd like now to welcome to the program Father Columba Stewart. He is a Benedictine monk, he is a professor of theology, and he's executive director of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And Tom Leach is with us. He is director of the Palace Press here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he's the curator of the St. John's Bible exhibit at the New Mexico History Museum. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, Father Columba Stewart will be giving a lecture on Sunday, the 25th of March at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum called Endangered Texts, Preserving Ancient Books the Benedictine Way in the 21st Century. Now, let's talk about that. It's a long-time Benedictine tradition to preserve manuscripts. What has this looked like in the past?
Well, there's a stereotype that people have, or a mental picture of a Benedictine monk hunched over a desk, copying out a manuscript with a quill. In fact, writing it much the way the St. John's Bible has been written, even in modern times. So there's an instinct for preserving human culture in the form of books, which, of course, for the greater part of human history meant writing it out by hand or carving it into stone or pressing something into a clay tablet. And we modern Benedictines are still committed to that kind of work. So our monastery, since 1965, has been going around the world photographing manuscripts, especially in places where they were thought to be endangered. First with microfilm, now with digital technology.
And they were thought to be endangered for reasons that are all too human, like the fear of nuclear war destroying everything or destroying a great deal, and just violence and war zones and conflicts in nations.
Exactly. So we started off in Europe working in Austria in the 1960s, at a time when many people thought there would be a third world war in Europe using nuclear weapons, and that what was left of our own Benedictine culture would be destroyed. But we quickly moved beyond Europe to working in Ethiopia in the 1970s, in a place where modernization was threatening traditional cultures, where manuscripts were being stolen from churches and monasteries and sold on the black market. And more recently, we've been doing quite a lot of work in the Mideast, in places like Syria and Iraq, and other places that are all too much in the news, both because their ancient Christian communities are immigrating and being persecuted, and because things are simply being lost and destroyed.
Now, how are you doing this? You're photographing these things, or are you scanning them, or what? I mean, what is the technology actually like?
We use a digital single-lens reflex camera. So it's a very high-end version of what a very serious amateur photographer might take on a vacation. But we use a particularly high-resolution, durable version of that. And we've managed to create studios which are fairly portable, which are not extremely expensive or highly delicate. In other words, which can function in conditions which aren't always optimal. And we train local people how to do the actual photography of the manuscripts. We have a field director based in Beirut, Lebanon, who does a lot of the training and monitoring of progress. And through the miracle of modern communication, we can have daily contact with all of these projects around the world through email, Google Docs, and other ways that we track progress, do troubleshooting. And then we ship hard drives with the images back here to Minnesota, where we process them and catalog them and put the results online.
Now, what are the actual manuscripts that you're photographing? Are they all sacred, so-called sacred texts, the Bible itself, the Quran, things like that? Or are they other kinds of histories that have made it this far? What are they?
Every kind of human knowledge, because then as now, there were people interested in religion, there were people interested in science, mathematics, history. So we photograph whatever we find in a manuscript collection. So if there's a church or a museum, library, monastery, which through one miracle or another has managed to protect manuscripts over the centuries, we photograph every single manuscript there. Now, because these are traditional cultures, obviously there's a pretty high proportion of the books which are religious. But there are also chronicles of history, including really fascinating things like what the Crusades looked like in the Middle East to Middle Eastern Christians, who had been living with Muslim neighbors for centuries and for whom the arrival of the European Christian liberators wasn't unalloyed good news. We find translations of Greek scientific works. We find controversies among religious groups. So it's really everything and anything that people thought was worth writing down.
And in probably a lot of languages, too.
They certainly are. Our earliest work was Latin. We very quickly started working in Ethiopia with ancient manuscripts in their language, which is called Ge'ez, which is a Semitic language. More recently, we've been doing quite a lot of work in languages like Syriac and Arabic and Armenian, and in Southwest India, in Old Malayalam, one of the local languages in which an ancient Christian community was preserving their history, written on palm leaves. So we have quite a team of experts who actually catalog these and describe their contents.
We're talking to Father Columba Stewart about endangered texts and preserving ancient books. Now, first of all, there's this question of how you find these books, and then the question of what kind of a relationship do you need to build with the people who own them, whether it's an institution or an individual or whatever, in order to let you set up your studio and photograph them?
Well, sometimes these manuscripts are known collections. So somebody visited them maybe 100 years ago, but we know that they actually exist. In other cases, there's a collection which was known to exist in an earlier time, but it's moved. And then we have to track down where it may be hiding now because the community that preserved it came under persecution and had to move and took with them their manuscripts. Or in some cases, the community disappeared entirely, and we have to see if there's any vestige of their handwritten culture. In other cases, somebody within a particular tradition or region will say, you know, you really should visit such and such a place. And so I go, or we send one of our team and start building a relationship, because these aren't business deals where you just go in and say, I have a proposal I'd like to make, and let's shake hands and then do this work. These are places which have long-standing traditions, which work on the basis of relationships, and also which are often suspicious of foreigners, and sometimes for good reason.
There is the whole question of, when you have an archive, not only what's in it, but ultimately how it's being used, because the value of that archive ultimately ends up being how scholars are able to make use of that and then turn it into something that the rest of us can make use of.
You're exactly right. And one of the first things we need to do when we meet with people who are taking care of manuscripts is to introduce them to that idea that the manuscript actually becomes more valuable if others are allowed to read it, and that it can also introduce a much wider audience to the tradition and history of the people who have, often at great cost to themselves, taken care of these manuscripts for centuries.
Do you have any favorite manuscripts or favorite stories that have come out of this project?
Oh, there are lots of interesting stories. I'll tell some of them on Sunday at the lecture at the museum. Other stories I'm not going to be able to tell for a while until we finish particular projects or conditions in a particular location improve to the point where I can reveal some of the secrets of manuscripts hidden in attics or communities which disappeared but left their manuscripts and what it took for us to find them. But I do keep a journal of all of these adventures, and it is a pretty fascinating story of following often ancient footsteps to find what they wrote about their own experiences.
Give us a hint of, like, maybe one of them that is no longer a secret, but, okay, you're following these footsteps, and there are some stories of people who encountered the Crusades. What do they say?
Well, they'll write, for example, about the fact that when the Europeans came to the Middle East on the Crusades, that the local Christians were the ones who were punished for the fact that there were these invaders who were fighting with the Muslim rulers. And so you find sort of heartbreaking stories about Christians who were forbidden to ring their church bells, for example, as a punishment to them for what was being done by their co-religionists who'd come from far away uninvited. This particular manuscript, which tells this story, is one that was seen in the 19th century by a European scholar when it was still in Turkey, with the community which had taken care of it for almost 500 years, the only copy of a manuscript originally written in the 12th century. That particular community was forced to leave Turkey in 1923 because of the persecution of Christians in the aftermath of World War I in connection with the Armenian genocide, but it affected other communities as well. It was then taken to Syria and locked into a safe in a church in Aleppo, a city very much in the news now because of the current crisis in Syria. And no foreign scholar was allowed to see it until 4 years ago, when we managed to convince the bishop and the local community that they should open up that safe, take out the manuscript, allow us to photograph it, publish it, and translate it, so that modern people could read this experience of these Middle Eastern communities centuries ago undergoing some of the same things that they're experiencing again today.
Now, Christianity and I guess probably all religions are supposedly about becoming better and kinder people. And sometimes when I think about, I mean, the kind of conflicts that you're describing and all of the paper and all of the work of writing these many texts and all the different factions and missionaries and people telling one group they have to do everything a new way and burning the old texts that represent the old ways. And I find myself wondering, are any of these texts actually doing their job or the intended job behind them to help people accomplish this basic fundamental goal of becoming a better person?
Well, it's hard to know what was in the mind of the people who wrote them. In most cases, they were probably arguing more for their particular side or trying to protect their own community. Our hope is that when we read them today, when we look back on the experience of these people who were living in complex societies with many different religious groups and ethnic groups, that when we read them today as scholars, and particularly when we can read manuscripts of one tradition alongside the manuscripts of another, in other words, doing the kind of conversation among traditions that may not have happened at the time the manuscripts were actually written, that can help us get a better picture of what the common issues might have been, and that we might learn a somewhat different perspective on our own understanding of history, and that it might help us do better the next time. In any case, we're trying to make that possible in the hope that somebody will take up that challenge.
We're talking to Father Columbus Stewart of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library in Collegeville, Minnesota. It's part of St. John's University. Now, some of the pages of these many manuscripts are interesting, and we'll talk to Tom Leach in just a moment about the exhibit that's at the New Mexico History Museum right now, but some of these pages are interesting from a purely art historical and aesthetic point of view. There's just a lot of sheer beauty in these manuscripts you're working with. Can you describe some of the things you've found?
We found some extraordinary illuminated manuscripts. One of the things that people don't often realize in the West, because we're used to looking at books of hours and these beautiful illuminated medieval manuscripts, is that in other parts of the early Christian world and the Islamic world, there were very strong traditions, both of beautiful writing, calligraphy, and of actual manuscript illumination. So, for example, Syriac and Armenian manuscripts belonging to these Eastern Christian communities continued traditions of manuscript illumination, which were also found in Byzantium, and developed their own artistic idioms, which are just astonishing. And you'll find people who will argue, for example, that Armenian Christianity perfected the art of manuscript illumination. And it's manuscripts like that we've been photographing throughout the Middle East. Now, some of these have been seen by Western scholars. Many of them have not. So we're expecting that the art historical understanding of manuscript culture, as well as the literary understanding of manuscript culture, will change once people are able to look at some of the manuscripts we're digitizing.
Are these manuscripts, once you have them photographed and cataloged and so on, are they available online?
What we do is we put a cataloging record for each one online and sample pictures. And then if somebody wants to look at a manuscript, they can send us a request and we'll give them an online gallery where they can look at a complete manuscript or several manuscripts. We don't put everything online at once because we have, at this point now, 125,000 complete manuscripts in our photographic archive. It's something over 40 million pages. And we just can't throw all that up on the web. It's just impossible. It's too much stuff. But we do everything we can to create access to things for the people who can work with them. And we do put those samples up so that anybody can browse and just get some idea of what these ancient manuscripts look like.
The scholars who are working with these and who are able to read these various languages from the last, you know, millennium or two, what countries do they tend to come from? Are you getting people from all over the world using these manuscripts?
All over the world. We have people who are themselves members of these particular communities who may live anywhere, because so many of these, especially places in the Middle East, people are now living around the world because they've left for economic opportunity or because of persecution. We also have many scholars from Europe who are trained in these long-standing European traditions of learning languages from various places. And some of these seemingly esoteric languages are becoming very popular in American graduate schools as well, because people are realizing that when you study the past, you can't study Latin Europe or Greek Byzantium in isolation from the rest of the world. So you have to study Armenian or Syriac or Arabic to get a full picture of what the Mediterranean world was like, much less when you want to expand your view, say, into the Silk Road and on the way to India. So one might think this is pretty obscure stuff, but actually the study of history is moving in the direction of using more and more of these manuscripts in their languages.
It paints a picture of a whole world of scholars and historians working, and one just has such a desire to have access to that. I mean, I guess every year lots of these historians write books that only other historians in their field will read, and yet one wishes for kind of the major themes and lessons to be more readily available to the general public.
I think that's beginning to happen. There have been some good popular books published in recent years trying to talk about these so-called lost traditions or invisible traditions of ancient Christianity. There's a lot of good work being done now and making its way into a more popular forum on relations between Christians and Muslims in the Middle East in the early centuries of Islam, which is one of the things that can be illuminated by our manuscript collections. And I think there's a little more evidence in the media about some of these ancient traditions, whether it's the ancient Jewish communities from Ethiopia or India, or whether it's some of the lesser-known traditions of Islam, or Christians in places like Iraq and Syria, who are very much in the news because of what's been happening to their communities. But the first thing that has to happen is digging into the stuff from a scholarly perspective, and gradually it can make its way to a more popular level.
We're talking to Father Columba Stewart. Now, Tom Leach, tell us, just remind us about the exhibit that's going on at the New Mexico History Museum, the St. John's Bible, which will eventually find its permanent home in Minnesota at St. John's University. This is, how shall I say it? It's an undertaking that's so extraordinary that anybody who hasn't seen it must rush over there. Actually, they don't have to rush as quickly as all that, because the exhibit's been extended.
Yes, whereas it was supposed to close April 7th, it will now continue through December 30th. We've been very fortunate to get that extension, and I think it's a reflection of the St. John's community's confidence in our ability to take care of their masterpiece.
Excellent. Now, this is one, the lecture which is coming up on Sunday with Father Columba Stewart. It's at 2 o'clock, Endangered Texts, Preserving Ancient Books the Benedictine Way. But will you have more programs around this exhibition?
Well, yes. We haven't planned them all. And as you know, the St. John's Bible is shown in conjunction with the Contemplative Landscape, another exhibit of photography sacred sites in New Mexico. And so most of our programming for the rest of the year was planned around the photography exhibit. But because of this extension, we will have more of these outstanding speakers.
And just to, if you don't mind, for people who haven't heard of this exhibit yet or haven't been to see it, what is it?
Well, we are showing 44 pages from two volumes, two of the seven volumes of the St. John's Bible. And we're showing pages from prophets and wisdom books. And, of course, these pages are full-scale, large manuscript, meaning made by hand, illuminated and hand-calligraphed, handwritten, beautiful calligraphy on these pages.
For the first time in, what, 500 years or something like that a project has been undertaken?
We say it's the first time in 500 years something on this scale has been attempted. I personally think nothing like this has ever been done. I've been looking at books most of my 62 years, and I've just never seen anything like this.
Father Columba Stewart, when this gigantic set of pages, when this gigantic manuscript ends up making its home at St. John's University, how will it be used or stored or kept there?
Well, eventually we'll bind it in seven volumes so that it will look like a traditional manuscript. And we already use high-quality facsimiles of the St. John's Bible in the liturgies of St. John's Abbey. Now, whether we'll use the actual original or not, we'll have to see once it's bound, although we have on occasion used single pages from it for major liturgical celebrations. But it will certainly become a focus for pilgrimage, whether for spiritual reasons or for people interested in art and the art of the book especially. We always have pages on display here at St. John's, and people are coming through daily to see exhibitions on a somewhat smaller scale than what they can see in Santa Fe right now. And we hope eventually to have a proper, fully dedicated gallery to show the St. John's Bible in a way that it deserves.
Now, I have to ask you, how long have you been a Benedictine monk?
I've been a Benedictine monk now for 31 years. Came in my early 20s.
And was it a calling for you? I mean, how did you get into that line of work, so to speak?
Well, I had a sense when I was young that I wanted to pursue some kind of religious vocation, but didn't know what it was, really. I had academic interests. I had interest in liturgy and spirituality. And I found the Benedictines. And in the Benedictine world, you don't join an order. You join an individual monastery. And I found a monastery which had a university, which had this manuscript project, which had an ecumenical institute, which had all kinds of things that could use my academic interests, and also had a community of very talented, very welcoming men. And so it's been a good fit.
And so it's a life of something that probably most of us can't even really imagine, which is a life of community and scholarship and really lifelong connection with a group of people.
That's right. So we're a community of about 150 monks, one of the larger ones in the U.S. We pray together four times a day. We take our meals together. We do all sorts of different kinds of work, but most of it is done here at St. John's itself. We have a few monks who also work in parishes, but generally our work is done here on the campus in Collegeville. And over a lifetime, you grow together. And one of the great blessings of our life is it's a multi-generational community. So we have people in their 20s, we have people in their 90s, and that's a pretty rare experience these days.
Father Columba Stewart is a Benedictine monk. He's a professor of theology and executive director of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's College in Collegeville, Minnesota. Tom Leach is the director of the Palace Press here in Santa Fe and curator of the St. John's Bible exhibit at the New Mexico History Museum. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You're most welcome, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kathy Connolly. She's Director of Public Affairs and Tourism for the Town of Taos. And Cherie Burns, she's a journalist. She's the author of the book Searching for Beauty, The Life of Millicent Rogers. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so we're here to talk about I'm going to call it a phenomenon. It's called
I like that.
Remarkable Women of Taos and Northern New Mexico. And this is basically a theme that comprises a whole lot of different events and works that are happening, all through this year?
Yes, during 2012. We try to have a theme every year. This one is just knock it out of the ballpark, spectacularly popular and wonderful. To leverage media coverage throughout not only the nation but internationally every year, and for a place for our community to participate. So the Remarkable Women of Taos in Northern New Mexico is connected to the Centennial. It's connected to our wonderful museums, core museums, the Millicent Rogers, the Harwood with Agnes Martin Off the Grid exhibit, and the Blumenshine and the Martinez Hacienda, and also our conference centers, the Mabel Dodge House as being one of them, premier. And it's an incredibly appropriate story for Taos. We have not only wonderful contemporary women who are featured on our website, taos.org, and are being added to. We have probably 90 right now, but we're legendary as well as contemporary, and we're adding to that throughout the year. So it's a traveler education theme. We have a rich and complex message, so it's a great way to tell it.
And Taos became a center for, well, in the modern age, the center for kind of a magnet for artists in, I believe, 1898, when somebody's wagon wheel broke and they ended up staying in Taos. Who was that?
Oh, it was Blumenshine and Sheree. Who was the other one?
I think it was
Phillips.
Blumenshine.
And they just happened to be traveling through. Their wheel broke.
They were going to, my understanding, Southern California and Mexico to do all sorts of art. The railroads out of Chicago had hired them in the past to do posters of the West, you know, go west on the railroad. And they had a broken wagon wheel north of town, and one of them rode the horse in to get it fixed, and they fell in love with Taos, Taos Pueblo, and the small plaza area, Hispanic plaza area of what we now know as the town of Taos. And they just decided this was it. They didn't have to go further.
Well, they were also painters, and I think that both the light and then the Native American form and all that was there and the colors in that, that gave them great things to paint.
And then we know the story of Mabel Dodge Lujan, who came from back east and just decided that this was the place that was going to teach the rest of the world to save civilization.
Well, I think that Mabel, when she came, she fell very much in love with Taos, and as did many Anglo women, particularly of means, who came out here. She fell madly in love with the Indians, and she also saw their culture as a cure for what was going on in the rest of the country. They were the new utopian, or new utopianist was their title. But Mabel was so connected and had been so much a part of Salon culture and also Greenwich Village in New York that wherever she went, she recruited people. And so she became this gateway where a lot of people then followed, including Andrew Dossberg in the arts community there in Taos. So she brought a lot of people, I mean, be it Carl Jung. She got Taos on the map in that sense at that time.
D.H. Lawrence. Even Georgia O'Keeffe came out because of Mabel. So she invited people, even if she didn't know them, if she felt that they would get it.
So let's talk for a moment about Millicent Rogers, about whom you've written a book. She was somebody who had, well, first of all, a lot of money, a lot of husbands, a great love with Clark Gable. And how did she end up in Taos?
Well, she came to Taos after a very glamorous life through the first half of the 20th century. She was a Standard Oil heiress, so she went everywhere with a great flourish. But she'd had a love affair with Clark Gable after the war. And when he dropped her, more or less, her friends there, Janet Gaynor and Gilbert Adrian, who was Gaynor's husband, who was a fabulous clothing designer for all of the many of the women in Hollywood, they knew New Mexico. They knew Santa Fe. They knew Pewaukee. And Gilbert Adrian knew Mabel Dodge Luann. So they brought Millicent here basically to mend her, give her a change of scene and mend her broken heart. I don't think they anticipated that she would fall madly in love with it and it would become her next location, but it was that great convergence of a place and her readiness to be here, and she fell in love and with it, and she stayed.
And she lived here, what, was it the rest of her life?
She lived here for the last 6 years of her life.
And
she came in 47.
How do you see her contribution to New Mexico?
Well, I think that she was a fashion icon before she came to New Mexico. And because of her relationship with Diana Vreeland in New York, she popularized that look that we have come to think of as Southwestern style or Southwestern fashion. And certainly well before Ralph Lauren, well before the hippies and, you know, certain style elements that are in that. I think that's the longest lasting. I think she joined that parade of women that came because it was liberating to be here, because they were ready to shed some of the social and other restrictions of their lives in society in the East Coast and other places. But I think she's best remembered for style and fashion. But the time she was here, you know, Millicent was not very well. She had had rheumatic fever as a child. She had a weak heart. And though people remember her for the parties that she had, and she was, boy, was she a collector. She went out on the Indian lands and she bought all of that wonderful pawn jewelry and immediately adopted the Indian broomstick skirts and those fashions. So that is really the longest and in most enduring impression of hers, I think.
There is a Millicent Rogers Museum. Tell us about that.
Well, that is a wonderful museum. It's sort of the gem of the Southwest in that it's in an adobe house, not one that was hers. But when she died in 1953, she left, the numbers vary, but certainly more than 2,000 pieces of Indian jewelry and the things that she had collected during her time here. And her mother was still alive, her three sons were still alive, and the story goes the attorney that came to help with the estate said, "What are we going to do with all this junk?" And the family said, "Let's make a foundation," and that foundation has made its way to being the Millicent Rogers Museum.
Now, what is being shown at the museum for this remarkable women event?
Well, they have, first of all, in Taos.org, we have all the exhibits throughout the year, and there are about seven at the Millicent. There's one having to do with fashion and how fashion impacts society and vice versa. Right now, there's Millicent is featured in many things because her collection is there and wonderful. There's also their gala later this summer, which is a wonderful thing to attend. It's going to be extended 3 or 4 days this August, I believe it is. And then they also have Taos Portraits, which we'll be showing in June, which is a new book of legendary faces of Taos, if you will, that features a lot of women. So, again, go to Taos.org and click on Remarkable Women. You can read all about the Millicents.
Now, we can't talk about remarkable women without talking about George O'Keefe and Agnes Martin. Let's talk about Agnes Martin for a moment. There's an intriguing-sounding exhibit called Agnes Martin Before the Grid. We think of her as so much as doing these straight lines and grid paintings, which, for reasons that I've never been able to figure out, are very moving and mesmerizing. What did she do before that?
She did some minimalist work. She did some figurative work. Interestingly enough, I'm no expert on Agnes, but I've been reading about her, and she just wanted to buy back and destroy a lot of her early work.
Is that right?
Because she felt that it wasn't representative of the artist she wanted to be remembered for. But luckily, some of it was saved, and it really, she was convinced not to destroy all of it because it shows the evolution to younger artists of the fact that, you know, you just don't spring forth as a young artist necessarily where you're going to be in 20 or 30 years. So it shows the evolution, and it's part of some writers who are trying to do a better job of describing exactly Agnes's evolution. So it's a great show. If you can get to Taos just to see that show, that would be worth it.
It's a great show. You know, the Harwood Museum, they have a yoga class there, and I do that yoga class in that Agnes Martin gallery. And
really?
It's a fabulous room with the oculus at the top. And, of course, you're always warned not to do a headstand and fall into these very valuable Agnes Martin paintings. But they are the real cool, minimal blue and white ones. And I found it so fabulous to be able to go back and see the earlier work. She may have wanted to disown some of it, but from the viewer's point of view, I think it's very interesting to be able to preface what you're seeing now with what she was doing then.
And the Harwood's gone through an expansion in the last year, too. So the Mandelman Reebok Gallery and Beatrice Mandelman will be featured as part of their shows later this year.
And what is Georgia O'Keeffe's role in The Remarkable Women?
Well, certainly we include her. She's fabulous. She didn't really live in Taos, but was a frequent visitor, and I think fell in love with New Mexico in Taos. But Abiquiu is where she's located. We're including not only Abiquiu, but Los Alamos and many other areas. The women in the arts out of Santa Fe are participating, too. So it's including all of northern New Mexico. And there's just so much that I would miss if I tried to feature specific deals. But we do have itineraries that are free and downloadable online that are seasonal that feature all the exhibits.
Well, I have in front of me flyers for a half a dozen self-guided tours and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you've actually made it really not only easy, but just kind of intriguing for somebody who is visiting, or indeed those of us who live here, to do a kind of tour of the Taos area and encounter these remarkable women.
Well, yes. All of us have less and less time on a daily basis. And so
Why is that?
I think it's technology is helping us have less and less time. We're expected to do more and more. So one of the things we recognized also through some national studies of travelers is people say, I love the thought of New Mexico, but what is there to do there? And for some of us in New Mexico who were thinking of a long weekend, this also helps tremendously to have these itineraries that really you can download it again online or come into the visitor center and pick one up, and it really helps you with a nice 3-day vacation. So,
doing a theme like this is not only educational for those of us who are either living here or people who are coming to visit and driving through New Mexico, whatever. It's also really part of the economic development of a city and county like Taos. What does that actually look like?
Well, tourism is very important in Taos, particularly. It's next to construction and government. It's really the largest employer, if you will, if you count every restaurant, hotel, an entity that is focused on the tourism dollar. Tourists tend to spend upwards of $170 a day. That's a state statistic. That's domestic travel. So it's a very important generator. We have a lot of day trippers, and we welcome them with open arms. We try to help them see that there's so much to do in Taos. They need to come back for a second overnighter. But you know, we have many, many jewels in New Mexico. They're all different. They're all unique. And we just want people to come and fall in love with the one that fits their personality and why they travel. So I think we're doing that more and more. I think the state's doing a great job of trying to work with us to do that statewide and to integrate. We have only about 1% of the domestic travel market in the state. And we need to grow that. We're a state that really relies on tourism. I believe it's the third largest economic generator in the state for all of us. So we're trying more and more to collaborate not only throughout our region but throughout the state, with the state. But also, Taos has a unique, complex, and rich story that I think really lends itself to free media. And so these travel themes are really focused on maximizing that. Last week, we were in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and from India to Seattle, we were featured with this theme.
India?
Yes, like the India Daily picked up the story.
So. About remarkable women.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's also, it resonates with us. You know, we've all been talking before we got on the air about what's in the water in Taos, that we have so many remarkable women. And
artists in general.
And creative people. And it's just a mecca. It almost generates its own its own energy. And I think certainly Taos Pueblo and our heritage, our creative culture, adding to it in 1898, but even today, there are a lot of contemporary artists and writers and musicians, and go on and on.
Well, and even these women, when you look at them closely, they were a very disparate group. I mean, there is certainly that well-to-do Anglo woman that came and did fall in love with the native culture, but Georgia O'Keeffe, she wasn't the most sociable and pleasant person to deal with in a lot of ways. She was reclusive. She was difficult. You have Mabel, who I think was a queen bee, but the door was always open. She was very, very expansive. when you look at them, Millicent was very different. She was not an intellectual. She was a socialite and had been in lots of ways and was used to certainly having her own way and doing things in her own terms. But then you had Helene Wurlitzer, who came and really created what I think is the longest lasting artist in residency program. She eschewed Mabel. You know, these were different personalities, and they all managed to find a way to fit and leave their impression there.
And the website, we feature about 90 contemporary women as well as legendary women from all cultures, all time periods. And we just honored Patricia T. Romero, who is a potter who has passed away from Taos Pueblo, who now has a new historic marker. And there, you know, the legends and stories just go on and on.
Well, as you said before we started, Taos was a creative community before 1898. It goes back another
100 plus years.
Yeah, exactly.
Taos Pueblo, sure. Macacious pottery being at the top of the list. So, yeah, it is in the water. Taos is inspirational. I think, you know, even if you're popping in for a quick weekend, it's relaxing, rejuvenating, heritage and culture, but it's a relaxing place. Our whole ambiance is supportive of creativity and relaxation.
Yeah, it makes Santa Fe seem like the fast lane.
Yes. There you go.
Now, Cherie Burns, your book, Searching for Beauty, The Life of Millicent Rogers, has been very popular. You've been doing a lot of traveling. It's gone into, its fourth printing?
It's fourth printing. What, I'm excited.
What that kind of a nerve do you think it's touching? I mean, to what do you attribute its success? The beauty of this woman? Or?
I think it's the story. When people ask me about Millicent and why I picked her and why you would spend, you know, the four and a half years that I did writing this book, I'm saying, you know, it's that her life was a great story. I mean, it was emblematic of the first half of the 20th century. She was the product of great wealth. She was a debutante. She was a flapper. She lived those heady expat days in Europe. I mean, it was really closer to the end of her life that she came to Taos. That was the real distinctive piece when she quit just going to the forefront of American glamour, really. So it's always hard to put your finger on the appeal of a book, but I think people like a good story. That's why I wanted to do it and why I enjoyed writing it. It was a story that had not been told. It's always fun to do the first comprehensive story. And that's what it was all about. And she was glamorous and had lots of clothes and lots of men,
yes,
and lots of lovers.
Her jewelry, designed jewelry. And the museum is exquisite. The collections are just over the top, wonderful. Our European travelers particularly just adore going there.
Cherie Burns is author of the book Searching for Beauty, The Life of Millicent Rogers. Kathy Connolly is director of public affairs and tourism for the town of Taos. Check out taos.org and check out CherieBurns.com. And above all, check out Remarkable Women of Taos in Northern New Mexico. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to welcome Tony Bass. He's with the Girl Scouts of New Mexico Trails, and he is here to tell us about the Cookie Caper, which is coming up very soon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate being here. This is great. We have the Girl Scouts of New Mexico Trails have our annual gala fundraising event, and it's coming up on March 30th, and we call it the Cookie Caper. And everyone is really familiar with our Girl Scout cookies and how great they are. And what we do at this event is we gather some of the top chefs in New Mexico, and they get to do the creative magic with the Girl Scout cookies, and they make these fantastic out-of-the-world desserts. And everyone is invited to come and taste them all out, and we hand out prizes to the top chefs. And in addition to that, we also have some of the best artists from around the state make cookie jars for the Cookie Caper as well. So it's kind of our way of making an adult version of the Girl Scout cookies, and so we get to see what they do. It's really amazing.
So you basically have amazing gourmet chefs making amazing desserts out of, like, those mint Oreo thing. What are they called?
Thin mints, yes.
Yeah, those thin mint Oreo cookie types of cookies.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
Which are good all by themselves.
That's what I said. When I first heard about this event, I thought, oh, well, you know, I mash up some thin mints and put in some brownies so I could probably compete or something like that. But no. Not even close. They make these these basil-infused thin mint milkshakes. 1 year we had a chef make white chocolate raspberry thin mint martinis, which just shows just how adult and just how like sophisticated it gets. And it's just every year that's the most exciting part for me is every year getting out there and seeing, wow, what these chefs really did with these things. It's amazing.
This is not a kid event.
No, not at all. This is an adult event, and it helps support programs for our Girl Scouts, but it's for adults, yes.
And it's Friday the 30th of March. Where is it?
It is at the Inn and Spa at Loretto, right here in Santa Fe.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be a beautiful venue. We have, as well as you'll be able to taste all the desserts ahead of time, and we have, you can also bid on the desserts. Each chef's going to make a big display. So if you find one that you really like, you can take it home, share it with your friends, share it with your family. And you can bid on that. We also have, you can bid on the pottery, which is always just fantastic. And as well as a very nice silent auction that we have going on. We have trips to Angel Fire, all sorts of great things.
Now, let's talk just for a moment about the Girl Scouts. What kind of activities are the Girl Scouts of... I guess this is it's not the Girl Scouts of New Mexico, it's like the kind of north central region of New Mexico.
Yes.
What kind of things are those Girl Scouts up to?
We represent 23 out of the 33 counties in New Mexico. Pretty much if you draw a line from Gallup over to Clovis up north, that's us. That's the Girl Scouts of New Mexico Trails.
Okay.
And we are providing, this is our 100th anniversary this year of Girl Scouts actually, so we have a lot of really great activities going on. And the 100th anniversary has been really great because that allows us to, it's an opportunity to show the community how we're actually stepping forth into the 21st century for the Girl Scouts and offering programs for them to help them discover their courage, confidence, and character and help them become the future leaders that New Mexico needs. So we have a lot of really great things from, you know, we have a lot of the traditional things like camping and the cookie sales, which everyone remembers, which actually the Girl Scout cookie sales is the best small business education for girls in the country. There's more small business owners that came out of Girl Scouts than some of the top colleges in the country.
Is that right?
Yes. And so it's not just when you see them out there, they're working on their marketing, they're working on their business plans, they're doing a lot of great things.
Yeah.
But we also have a lot of really great things like along the lines of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics programs for girls where they're learning how to design robots, to be engineers, doing a lot of these things. We just had a really great thing called First Lego League where girls program robots to complete activities and so they work on like global problems. This year the theme was food crises and how to solve a lot of the problems that are going along with food while designing robots. And we have just the Girl Scouts have become one of our board president always says it's not your grandma's Girl Scouts anymore. It's so much more than that. We have so many opportunities for girls to participate.
I would think also that with the camping would come an environmental stewardship piece and all of that.
Absolutely, yes. That's a huge part of Girl Scouting is, I know I used to go camping, and then when I became a Girl Scout, I learned that
you're
I can...
You're a Girl Scout. Tony is a Girl Scout.
I am a Girl Scout. That was my first day at work. I came home, told my wife, I'm a Girl Scout, and that was a conversation I never thought I'd have with her ever. She said, what are you talking about? But yeah, after going camping the first time with some as a Girl Scout, I learned there's a lot more ways to, you know, better your camp, make sure you leave the environment better, be a better steward for the environment. And so I learned a lot of that. So yes, certainly there's a lot of that.
Now, the Cookie Caper is, once again, Friday the 30th of March. And if people want to find out more and get tickets and things like that, what do they do?
They can go to our website, which is www.nmgirlscouts.org, NM like New Mexico. Or they can contact our council office, which is 505-343-1040. And we'll be happy to get you with some tickets. We space is filling up, so be sure to get them as soon as possible. That way you don't miss out on any of this. I can't tell you enough how amazing these desserts are.
Well, we look forward to it. Tony Bass is with Girl Scouts of New Mexico Trails. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Schaller. I appreciate it.